Thanks a lot for the invitation to speak. I'm a bit of a self-invited speaker because I'm attending the board meeting tomorrow, and I decided to give this mysterious title. Probably, in fact, I was just asked by Don what is the F theorem, it basically has to do with a measure of the hint is that it's supposed to be a lot like C theorem and the A theorem, except in three dimensions as opposed to two and four dimensions. So it has to do with attempts to define the number of conformal degrees of freedom in general field theory. And in three dimensions, it's notoriously difficult. In fact, the main thing to know about F theorem is that it's not yet a theorem. It's a conjecture, but A theorem was called the theorem long before it was proven, so.
Maybe you should call it F theory. Well, you might ask why the F, B is between C and A.
Well, you'll see why F might be a natural letter, but. Yeah, I realized all these possible conflicts after having coined this term. But yet I haven't been sued by inventors of F theories. So the talk will be largely based on these several papers. Some of them have to do with supersymmetric field theories where this quantity F can be computed exactly, even though the theories are strongly interacting. And this has to do with the magic of localization. Basically, what F is, it's minus the log of the exact path integral of the theory on the three-dimensional sphere. And on three-dimensional sphere, sometimes there are techniques to calculate the path integral exactly by reducing it to a finite-dimensional integral. So that's basically some of the stuff, and some of the stuff will have to do with trying to study more generally what this quantity F is. It turns out that it's well defined even without supersymmetry, but conformal invariance is basically enough to define it. So this will be the latter part of the talk. So now the basic philosophy is that there is a deep problem in general quantum field theory is how to define a good measure of the number of massless degrees of freedom which decreases along any RG flow and is also stationary at fixed points. In two dimensions, this was solved already in 1987 by Zamolochikov, who basically used two-point functions of the stress energy tensor and Lorentz invariance. So this definition relies on Lorentz invariance to define the so-called C function, which basically is well defined along any RG flow, and it's monotonic and monotonically decreasing and stationary at fixed points. And this is why. So this kind of sets the gold standard for what good RG theorems would be. So a few more words about what C is. So at RG fixed points, this is just a conformal anomaly curve. So there are many ways in two dimensions to describe this quantity C. One is the response of the VEV of the trace of the stress energy tensor to curvature. So the two-dimensional anomaly equation is that this is the well-known two-dimensional anomaly equation, and C measures the coefficient of R. It's also the Virasoro central charge, namely if you look at the central term in the Virasoro algebra, which is related to the two-point function of stress energy tensors, that's also measured by C. And it also very manifestly determines the number of degrees of freedom, namely if you look at the theory at finite temperature, then the coefficient in the relation F equals minus C minus something times t squared is proportional to c. So basically, in two dimensions, all roads lead to this golden quantity c, and the theorem is proven. And the main subject of the talk today is what could we possibly do in dimensions bigger than 2. So a kind of physicist definition of the number of massless degrees of freedom is fairly clear. You heat up the system, you consider it at finite temperature, and the more massless degrees of freedom there are, the bigger the coefficient of T to the D is in the theory in the D space-time dimensions. So if you, for example, normalize things so that C is equal to 1, then you get this definition from the thermal free energy. And of course, it can be extracted from the Euclidean path integral on Rd minus 1 times a circle, right, where the radius of the circle is the inverse temperature. Okay, so this sounds like a very plausible definition. And even there were papers proposing this as sort of the right definition, namely for the RGs. But it appears that while it works in many cases, it doesn't appear to always work. And one actually general way to see why this might fail is the following, that sometimes a theory can have a line of fixed points or exactly marginal direction. And then C certainly doesn't vary along in exactly marginal direction. But this quantity, because it breaks all supersymmetry, does vary along exactly marginal directions. And one very famous example is what happens in N equal 4 super Young-Mills theory, where the theory is well known to be conformal for any Toft coupling lambda, but the coefficient, so in that case we know that there is the relation that the thermal free energy is equal to minus n squared t to the 4 times some function of lambda. And this function is certainly non-constant. In fact, one of the early sort of quote-unquote paradoxes in ADS-CFT was the mismatch between 3/4 at strong coupling and 1 at weak coupling. But you don't even need ADS-CFT to see why it's not constant. You just do the leading perturbative computation, and you find that F of lambda is equal to 1 minus some A lambda plus B lambda to the 3/2, and so on. So there is certainly a there is no stationarity property. And stationarity property is sort of part of our list of important requirements. And then you can also find some examples where the C therm actually increases along RG flow. And I want to quote one example that I actually learned about from Subir Sachdev, which works in 3 dimensions. And this has to do with flows related to the O(n) vector model. So if you think about, so this consists of n scalar fields interacting with the phi dot phi squared potential. And then, of course, if you look at the UV theory, where you can ignore, so you can look at the RG flow from the free theory to the interacting theory produced by this relevant operator. In the UV, there are just n free fields, so CT would be n. But in the IR, Sachdev back in 93 showed that CT is 4 n over 5. So this part seems to work, right? It does work in the right direction. But then you can look at what happens when you deform this critical theory by a negative mass square term to drive it to the Goldstone phase. So you just implement some symmetry breaking and you get a Mexican hat potential. So in this Goldstone phase, you clearly get just n minus 1 free scalar fields in the infrared. So as the theory flows from the critical to the Goldstone phase, CT actually increases, right? Because it goes from 4n over 5 to n minus 1. So this looks like an example where it actually doesn't work. I don't know of too many explicit examples of this sort. I believe that the more concrete statement was proposed by Applequist and collaborators. I think Applequist, Schmaltz, and Turning, perhaps?
Cohen.
Cohen. That only in four-dimensional asymptotically free theories does this always decrease. Perhaps in that case there is no known counterexample. But still, what I think we would all like to have is a completely general theorem that doesn't rely on just asymptotically free theories and should work in all dimensions, and it appears that this doesn't work for the thermal free energy, although it clearly is a nice measure of degrees of freedom. But so let's go back to another idea for generalizing the two-dimensional C theorem, which is to go the anomaly route, right? We saw that C is the Weyl anomaly in two dimensions, and anomalies tend to have nice properties, namely they tend to be insensitive to marginal deformations. So let's try something similar in four dimensions, and this was done just a year or so after Zamolodchikov's paper by Cardi, and he observed the following thing. So if you look at the general four-dimensional conformal field theories, then there are actually two Weyl anomaly coefficients. One is proportional to the Euler density here, and the other one to Weyl tensor squared. And just for historical reasons, for some reason, someone decided to call this C and this A. Maybe it would have been better the other way around. But I think the logic, I think, was that this is related to the two-point function of the stress-energy tensor. So from that point of view, it's natural. And then it turns out that it's not hard to find counterexamples to the C theorem in four dimensions. Namely, there are RG flows where C actually increases. But Cardi proposed really that A is the golden quantity, even though his paper is called Is There a C Theorem in Four Dimensions? But he really had in mind this quantity A. And the reason he had it in mind is he actually performed a calculation on the four-dimensional sphere. And in four-dimensional sphere, the Weyl tensor is exactly zero. So you don't feel this C at all, and the anomaly just, the contribution to the integrated VAV of T is just coming from this A coefficient. And he basically conjectured in, I believe it's 87 or 88, that the A coefficient decreases along any RG flow and is stationary at the fixed points. And this was a subject of research over many, many years, right? Something like 23 years, until a very solid argument, perhaps a rigorous proof. I mean, it's certainly a physicist proof, was recently proposed by Kamargotsky and Schwimmer back in July. I won't talk about how they argued for this, but I'm sure you have had or will have talked on this. Maybe I even heard some of them on the web. But it essentially has to do with a certain special Weyl anomaly term that gets induced in the low energy effective action for the kind of dilettante field in arbitrary four-dimensional theory. And it turns out that its coefficient is related to AUV minus AIR, to the difference between infrared and ultraviolet values. And on the other hand, there is strong reasons to believe that in a unitary theory, this coefficient can only have one definite sign. Otherwise, you get some superluminal propagation and so on. So that's in a nutshell what their proof is based on. And I should say that even before this proof was constructed, there was a lot of accumulating evidence, in particular from n equal 1 supersymmetric theories. And in fact, there was this beautiful work by Intrilligator and Weft, who basically showed that in theories where, suppose you have an n equal 1 supersymmetric conformal field theory, in many of these theories, the R symmetry is not completely fixed a priori by the marginality of the superpotential. In other words, it can mix with some U1 flavor symmetry. And they showed that this mixing is determined by locally maximizing this coefficient A. Another fact that's very useful for n equal 1 theories is that that A in such series is just determined by these R charges of all the chiral superfields. So this immediately tells you that A is very likely to decrease along RG flow, because since you're all, you know, in any CFT you're locally maximizing A, usually when you flow you tend to break symmetries, so you have fewer degrees of freedom with respect to which to maximize. And there are many checks of this idea in specific examples. And also there was another nice tool, which is ADS-CFT correspondence. And there it was also, there was a holographic A theorem proven by, based on the idea of flowing from one ADS-5 cross Y manifold to another one. It was shown that essentially the A coefficient in that case is 1 over volume of Y, and one can show that this volume of Y tends to increase as you flow. So there were, even before this proof, there was a lot of sort of checks of this idea. But my main topic is how to try to extend this measure of degrees of freedom to odd dimensions where there are no anomalies. And it's particularly interesting in D equals 3 or in 2 plus 1 dimensions, because there are many CFTs in 2 plus 1 dimensions. As I showed, ON model is one example. You don't even need gauge fields. You can just construct good interacting conformal field theories just out of scalar or fermionic fields. And of course, there are lots of gauge theories too. For example, Chern-Simons gauge theories coupled to conformal matter. And some of them actually came into limelight also with the much improved understanding of ADS-CFT correspondence in three space-time dimensions for field theory, and the emergence of the ABJM model, which is the theory on supermembranes. So in a nutshell, what is being proposed is that the good measure of the number of degrees of freedom is something somewhat similar to what Cardi was calculating, but it also involves putting the Euclidean theory on a round sphere. But now, instead of calculating the VEV of the stress energy tensor, you simply just take the even a simpler quantity, just the VEV of the unit operator. Namely, you take minus log of the path integral. And that's why we decided to call it F, because it looks like a free energy, but feel free to rename it by another letter if you don't like this one. So in a nutshell, the conjecture is that FIR is less than FUV, and also that F is stationary at fixed points, and in particular, F is constant along exactly marginal deformations.
So why would you expect that passing to the 3-sphere gets rid of the
such-a-counter? Actually, one of my points was to show that for that particular counterexample is no longer a counterexample.
So you're talking about that?
Yeah, in fact, that's one of my sort of punchlines at the end. But very intuitively, the such-dev counterexample was for R2 cross S1, which is a bit of an asymmetric space, right? Here, you just have a very symmetric space. Just by conformal symmetry, there can be no dependence on R. Right? One question that people ask me a lot is, in a general field theory, this quantity is certainly divergent. Right? The raw calculation gives you something divergent, but the scale invariance allows you to remove divergences in an unambiguous way. Essentially, what happens in three dimensions is just the divergence of the cosmological constant. So if you look at G equals 3, F on this S3 of radius R will have the structure lambda times R cubed. And this typically is divergent, right? The UV divergent. Then there will be some R. And then there is 1 over G Newton. So this is another counter term that we need to add. And then there is just some pure number. Pure finite part, it turns out. And these are certainly not scale invariant terms. So there is a completely clean way to cancel them off.
So
and then you're left with a well-defined finite quantity. And I'll actually show you how to compute them for the simple CFTs like a conformally coupled scalar.
This means your thing is your F is finally the endpoints of the flow, not for the.
Yeah. I think there is no good proposal in general for the monotonic function. Yeah, I think that's. But that was a status with the A theorem also for quite a long time. Yeah, to prove it, you certainly need a monotonic function. But to make a conjecture, you just need. And the contrast with the 4D case. So what happens in 4D, right? For D equal 4, f of s 4 has a structure like lambda r to the 4 plus 1 over gn r squared. And here there is a log r. In that case, there is actually a logarithmic term. And the way you extract it is just by differentiating f with respect to log r, right? But such a term is not possible in three dimensions, and you just have a pure number. So
you can kill those terms like by evidence derivatives in some way.
Yeah, we tried a bit, but so far have not. Yeah, we actually played with some simple RG flows, like even like taking some massless field and then giving it a mass. It somehow, strangely enough, turns out to be hard just using the three sphere to construct a monotonic function with the usual zeta function regulator. But I think there is certainly space for improving this whole situation. But even like before these more grand ideas, a lot of people have been asking me, is it completely clear that this number is well defined? And this I'm fairly certain. I'm pretty certain that it is. And then there is a dual argument in ADS4 that it's well defined, which maybe now is a good time to show this argument too. Like you can, if you just compute, so what is f in ADS4? This is just it's just the value of the ADS4 action, right? So if you just write down some action like integral d4x root g r minus 2 lambda, right, 1 over pi g n. Okay, and then using Einstein equations, you basically know that r on shell r will be proportional to lambda, right? So at the end, the whole computation reduces to some regularized volume of ADS4, right? But now, if you look at the metric of ADS4. And this is Euclidean ADS4, which is asymptotic to the three sphere. That's the whole idea. So if you want to write it in this way, then you write this as d rho squared plus sinh squared rho d omega 3 squared. This is the metric of around three sphere. Now you're supposed to compute the volume of this. Now this volume is proportional to just integral d rho from 0 to some rho cutoff of just sinh cubed rho, right? And then you can just do it term by term, and then you find that there will be some divergent quantities, like there will be some divergence like e to the 3 rho c, and there will be some divergence like e to the rho c. But then there is a perfectly well-defined finite number. So after holographic renormalization, you just kill off these integrals, I mean these divergences, and then you're left with a convergent finite number. And one thing that I will show you is that this finite number exactly matches the field theory calculation of this S3. So this looks like the analog of the anomaly matching in ADS5 CFT4, where we were really matching the coefficient of log r. Here we can match the finite number in in many supersymmetric examples. Okay, so at least I hope I convinced you that it's plausible that this is a well-defined finite number. Now let me talk about a bit about localization and theories with extended supersymmetry. Then you can essentially reduce. So what is enough is just n equal to supersymmetry, where the integral is reduced to some n by n matrix, say in the UN gauge theory, which are the auxiliary fields in the gauge multiplet. And here there is a statement that Jefferis invented, which is completely analogous to the interligator left statement. He basically showed that whenever there is some freedom in R symmetry in D equals 3, it must be fixed by locally extremizing, and in fact, in all known examples, it appears to be maximizing this F. So there is at least this parallel step to which was important in working up to the A theorem. So let me talk about what I just started saying, which is ADS-CFT matching of F. Let's consider models which are dual to ADS-4 cross Y7, where Y7 can be some seven-dimensional Einstein space. The simplest one is a seven sphere, but then there are various other ones. And such theories arise on a stack of n M2 brains placed at the tip of an eight-dimensional Calabi-Yau cone. And then when you go through the subtraction of cubic and linear divergence, which I showed you here in a nutshell, that's all it is. It's just regularizing the volume of ADS-4. And then implementing the right flux quantization, you find that this F is precisely given in the supergravity limit by n to the 3 halves times some constant 1 over square root of volume of y. And you can ask me, how do you normalize volume of y? It's basically normalized so that rij is exactly, so for this y7, you have that rij is equal to 6gij, just some canonical normalization, which is standard in the supergravity. And this n to the 3 halves is a kind of standard feature of all the leading order calculations for M2 brain theories. For example, also the thermal free energy, as Zeitlin and I observed already in 96. And it always seemed like a very puzzling feature. Like, why would it be n to the 3 halves? At least when we did similar exercises in ADS-5, you always saw n squared. And n squared was very nicely indicative of UN gauge theory. Here you get n to the 3 halves. And it takes some getting used to. But one of the big unambiguous sort of pieces of progress in this field was actually explanation of how this n to the 3 halves comes about. And this is a prediction of ADS-CFT, and now we want to check that this prediction is actually verified. So let's look at the so-called ABJM theory, which is a theory of on M2 brains placed at the tip of a R8 mod ZK, so some where ZK acts by simultaneous rotations in the two planes. If you think of R8 as C4, basically it acts there. And it was conjectured that that the dual gauge theory is UN at level K, so this is Chern-Simons level, times UN at level minus K, with certain bifundamental matter. So it's a little bit strange that already for the simplest theory involves two gauge groups, so it's a product gauge theory. And moreover, the structure of this theory is a lot like the structure of the conifold for D3 brains on the conifold in four dimensions, but we don't really need to talk about this here. So there is a particular construction. There is a superpotential of the form ABAB for these fields, which is exactly marginal in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And this is one example of a theory to which Kapustin and collaborators, Kapustin, Willett, and Yakov, managed to apply their localization procedure. And then essentially you have integral over two matrices, one n by n matrix here and one n by n matrix here. And these n by n matrices are just the auxiliary fields of this Chern-Simons gauge multiplet. And their eigenvalues are labeled by lambda, lambda 1 through lambda n, and lambda tilde 1 through lambda tilde n. And the big triumph of their work was that they reduced it to just a particular integral. So it's an integral which is perfectly convergent, and you can start calculating it for n equal 2, 3, 4. I think the computer can do it without any problems. And maybe there are even more exact answers. You can actually do it analytically. But here, our goal is to do it in the large n limit. Okay, where, so suppose we keep k fixed, namely we keep the orbifold, the rank of the orbifold fixed, and send n to infinity, and we want to reproduce this n to the 3/2. So this should know. And this actually works, and this was initially established by Drucker, Marino, and Putrov, using a pretty high-powered mathematical relation. They basically knew how to solve similar matrix models back from the Diagraph-Waffa era and used that knowledge to do some analytic continuation. But then in one of the papers I listed on the second transparency with Chris Herzog, Silvio Puffo, and Ibi Tassiliano, we decided to take a more kind of pedestrian approach, which is, let's just see what are the eigenvalue densities, for example, for these two sets of eigenvalues. And we actually learned something pretty amusing from this. I mean, I won't even tell you the final word on it, but so one pretty interesting thing is that these integrals are perfectly convergent. They're not like the matrix models for 2D quantum gravity, which are always tuned to the brink of a phase transition. And then what my collaborators did is they wrote a program which, since it's a perfectly convergent integral, you can write a program which tells you where the eigenvalues sit. There's kind of settle point finder. And we pretty quickly saw that there is something pretty interesting happening. Namely, they just sit along lines in the complex plane with endpoints always hitting pi over 2 and minus pi over 2. So the imaginary part always ranges from minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. But the range horizontally grows like square root of n. Okay, and this was pretty clear already from playing with small number of eigenvalues. And then you see that why the semi-classical approximation may still be valid, because it's a little bit like just playing with the Gaussian matrix model with a normalization like integral dm e to the minus trace m squared. Then the eigenvalues will spread like root n, but there are still n of them. So the spacing between eigenvalues will still shrink, and you get a continuous distribution. So even in this case, it still works. And then we made an ansatz for the positions of eigenvalues, like say n to the alpha xj plus iyj, and the other ones look complex conjugate actually. So they sit on these two complex conjugate lines. And then the crucial thing was this: what we saw is that there had to be a cancellation of long-range forces. Namely, in the old Dyson gas, there were these logarithmic interactions. But here, what turns out to happen is that if you take, say, a given eigenvalue, all the distant lambdas forces cancel the distant lambda tilde forces. And then you can reduce everything to just completely local. Like instead of a double integral, there is a local effective action. And the first term went like n to the 1 plus alpha, the term just from the sort of classical potential from Chern-Simons proportional to k. And the second one went like n to the 2 minus alpha. And clearly, you need the balance of the two terms, so you immediately see that alpha is 1/2, and free energy goes like n to the 3/2. And I think since then, like, there are now several different ways to see the scent of the three halves. There was also a very nice, more recent paper by Marinho and Putrov, who looked at the eigenvalue density in phase space and saw some also very nice shapes. I mean, the amazing thing is that the exact solution actually gives you completely constant eigenvalue density. So what it does in this scaling limit is that so Wigner saw the semicircle law. This is the rectangle law. It just goes like this and drops sharply to zero. It's completely constant. And then there are more complicated models where it's just piecewise linear, like it constant and then decreases and then decreases. And then this was explained better in some subsequent work by Herzog and collaborators and by Marinho. There is some pretty interesting mathematics behind this. But the bottom line is that if you look at, say, the value of F for that simple model, it exactly reproduced ADS CFT because you got k to the 1/2, n to the 3/2. And remember that formula with 1 over square root volume. So the volume is 1 over k, so you get k to the 1/2 and so on. And this, in a sense, was already done by Drucker and collaborators. But then we also looked at some examples which have a bit less supersymmetry. And there are these more general quiver gauge theories where you have some nice necklace quivers which are labeled by a bunch of integer Chern-Simons levels. And they're dual to some cones which are also specified by their kind of hyperkähler quotients, which are specified by these sets of integers adding up to zero. And in that case, too, so there it wasn't just sort of one number. There was some complicated function of the k's. So you can like look at complicated model where there are many gauge groups and many k's. And in all those cases, again, there was a perfect agreement between the two functions. So that's a very nice ADS CFT matching of this number. But then, so this was all for the case with n equals 3 SUSY where there are no anomalous R charges. It turns out that n equals 3 completely fixes the dimensions of operators. But once you get to n equals 2, there is now freedom to have some more complicated dimensions. And there are lots of examples where there are proposed ADS CFT duals with n equals 2 supersymmetry. So here one has to use this Jefferies procedure of maximizing this integral. And we wrote a pretty longish paper checking like various examples. And in all cases after maximization, it precisely again agrees with ADS CFT. So it's pretty similar to the checks that were made for the simpler case of four-dimensional CFTs. So one example is, for example, the same ABJM model, but where you make, instead of fixing the dimensions to be 1/2 each, you make them arbitrary. And then there is sort of one example where you sort of take one of these dimensions out of consideration. You add some relevant operator which fixes one of the dimensions to be 1. And then the remaining ones will be 1/3 each. And then you can see it from maximization. They're basically maximizing the square root of the product of three dimensions. And that's maximized at 1/3 value. And you see that this flow, along this flow, FIR is smaller than FUV. And in fact, this flow is a well-known flow which Warner studied in gauge supergravity back in 1983, it turns out. It's a flow from S7 to some much more complicated warped, squashed, deformed fixed point of gauge supergravity. And this is essentially how the F coefficients work for that flow. So I think for the n equal 2 case, it's pretty clear that things are working out. But once you go below n equal 2, there is no more localization, or at least there is no known localization. So you can't seem to be able to do these exact matchings and computations. But there is still a question of whether this F conjecture still has a chance even without supersymmetry. Now the nice thing, as I explained, is that I think the fact that the F number is well defined does not depend on supersymmetry. It just depends on conformal symmetry. So let's consider the simplest possible non-supersymmetric CFTs. Let's say free theory. So one example of free theory is a conformally coupled scalar on a three-sphere, where there is a famous, you know, improvement term for the added to the Laplacian. Then if you just do the usual zeta function regularization of this determinant, you can express it. So one interesting thing that you see in all odd dimensions is that the term logarithmic in the radius of the sphere cancels by zeta function regularization. This is as it had to be because there is no anomaly. There is, and then you just have a well-defined finite number, which looks a little weird. Like you get things like 1/16 times 2 log 2 minus 3 zeta of 3 over pi squared. So it's not as simple as the values of anomalies. Like for anomalies, you usually just have some simple rational numbers. Here you even get transcendental number. But the interesting thing, even though this is not totally obvious, it almost cancels, but it still manages to stay positive. And I think positivity of this number is certainly an important property for unitary theories. Right? If this turned out to be negative, then our F theorem would be dead on arrival. So, and then we did a similar computation for, let's say, a massless Dirac fermion. And the interesting thing is that it's exactly like complex scalar, but except minus got replaced by a plus. So if you take a supermultiplet, then this transcendental term cancels out, and then you have something more palatable, which is actually one ingredient in these Kapustin et al. Localization computations. But without supersymmetry, you're stuck with these transcendental numbers. So these are pretty peculiar measures of the massless degrees of freedom, but it's not so be it. So these are just to show you that this computation of F basically makes sense even without supersymmetry in sort of the simplest theories. And then there is, of course, the famous computation for Chern-Simons theory on three-sphere, which was carried out by Witten back in the 80s, where you have some explicit number. For example, for the U1, if you just take the U1 Chern-Simons theory, U1 CS, you find that F is just equal to 1/2 log K. This comes from the fact that the exact integral in the three sphere is Gaussian. You essentially see that Z, which is integral dA e to the IK integral ADA, it's basically 1 over square root of K. And this is a pretty well-known result. So you get this answer. And here you have a truly dramatic difference from what the thermal definition of degrees of freedom told you, right? Because according to the thermal definition, you see no, it's a topological theory, right? You don't have any propagating degrees of freedom. However, this three-sphere definition tells you that F can be very large. So it's somehow feels this these topological degrees of freedom. And I'll mention at the end of the talk that this may have to do with quantum entanglement, because these quantities actually are related to certain entanglement entropy measures. Okay, so now we can try to make other checks of this. In fact, in Zamolodchikov's paper, one other check he made of his theorem is what happens if you add very slightly relevant operator. Then, in some sense, the theory flows very slowly, and you can see the decrease of his C function. So let's try to perturb the CFT by an operator whose dimension is 3 minus epsilon, where epsilon is small. And then we try just expanding the log Z in correlation functions of O with itself. We know that the 2 and 3 point functions are completely fixed by conformal invariants, and there is some OPE coefficient big C that we have here. And C can be either positive or negative. But we'll see that there is a pretty big difference in the structure of the flow. So now, just expanding this F, you see that the change in the free energy expanded in bare coupling is just lambda 0 squared I2 plus lambda 0 cubed I3 and so on. And these integrals can be done exactly on the 3 sphere. And then what you notice is that in odd dimensions, this answer here is of order epsilon, because 1 over gamma of epsilon is very small, and this does not go to zero or blow up. So you basically see that this quantity in D equal 3 is of order epsilon, and this quantity is finite. So the structure of the result will be minus epsilon G squared plus C G cubed. So even in terms of the bare coupling. And then expressing it in terms of renormalized coupling, we basically saw that delta F is decreasing. Like once the flow begins, delta F actually goes down. But then there can be, for a very small epsilon, there can be a nearby infrared fixed point, which is the famous general result. So if C is positive, you see that there is a fixed point at G star of order epsilon over C. That's still a very weak coupling. And one can then compute the change of F between UV and IR, and you have a decrease. And another interesting thing is that, at least within this approximation, the derivative of F with respect to G is proportional to the beta function, which exactly satisfies the stationarity property at the. Because to have this quantity stationary at fixed points, it has to. The derivative has to vanish at fixed points. Okay, so we see that delta F in this case is minus pi squared epsilon cubed over 72 C squared. And actually, after we did this computation, I felt very dense, because at some point I remembered that something like this was actually done by Affleck and Ludwig for D equal 1 long ago, and even I even worked on similar things back in the mid-90s, because their theorem, which they call the G theorem, now you see why F may fit better. The G theorem had to do with some sort of generalized ground state degeneracy, and what G is it's the same. It's sort of from the same opera as F. Like, you take the one-dimensional CFT, compactify it on a circle, and compute log Z. And that was the definition. The only difference is the sign. You see that, so in D equal 1, you have to take plus log Z. In D equal 3, minus log Z. In D equal 5, it's again plus log Z, and so on. So in that case, it was just a kind of thermal definition. You just compactify it on a circle. In 3D, you already feel the curvature. But it turns out that this type of computation is very similar to the one that Affleck and Ludwig did. So, and in that case, it's widely believed that there is a theorem. At least there is some partial proof of it by Friedan and Konieczny. So initially they did the conjecture very similar to on the level that we are making. Like, they looked at very slightly relevant operators, for example, and did a very similar type of Friedan and Konieczny considered theories where the D equal 1, it's like a boundary CFT. You have a conformal boundary condition in a two-dimensional CFT. So the interactions are, so it's like a BCFT theorem. Of course, in 3D, we could also consider sort of a three-dimensional theory, which is a boundary of a 4D theory. So they seem to have succeeded in proving it in that example. And yeah,
based on C theorem?
No. Well, it was, yeah, I don't remember exactly. Yeah, it seemed more complicated than just the 2D C theorem. But. Okay, so now, I need just a few more minutes. There is another example where one can do business, which is double trace flows. And the ON model that I discussed at the very beginning is one example of it, right? Because there the single trace operator is phi squared. Then you multiply it by itself, you have a double trace operator. And these kind of double trace operators can be disentangled using the Hubbard-Stratonovich trick by introducing some auxiliary field sigma. And then you can actually, you have some effective action for sigma, and you can compute some additional determinant, very similar to the zeta function computation that we have done. So you get some additional. So then delta F delta is given by some similar zeta function computation. And in all odd dimensions, this formula, for example, was derived by Diaz and Dorn. You can just derive this formula, which is completely analytic. And then for delta, so delta is the dimension of the single trace perturbing operator. Now for D equals 3, you see that the change in F is just given by this type of integral. And when we do the computation for the case of ON model, then delta is equal to 1, right? So it's integral from 1 to the 3/2 of this quantity. Turns out that it's given precisely by something, again, containing zeta of 3. Minus zeta of 3 over 8 pi squared, and you see clearly that it decreases. Okay, so, but the decrease, this is only order 1 difference. Unlike in Sachdev's computation, you see, in Sachdev's computation, the decrease was of order n. It went from n to 4n over 5. Here it goes from n to just n times something to just that same quantity minus a small order 1 correction. And this is a crucial thing, that the reason that there was an order n change in Sachdev's calculation is that there was a thermal mass shift. But somehow going from a plane to a sphere is a very mild operation. It's just a conformal map. There's absolutely no mass shift, and this certainly is what is happening. And because of this, there is no violation of the theorem when we now flow to Goldstone phase, because you just go down a little bit from the free to the critical model, and then you go down a little bit more to the Goldstone phase. And this is the purpose of this transparency. You see that the critical model answer is n times the free fermion minus zeta of 3. And the Goldstone phase is just n minus 1 times the free fermion, free scalar. And you see that this quantity is actually smaller than this quantity. So the violation went away, basically, on the 3 sphere. And you see that, indeed, F Goldstone minus F critical is negative. So there is no violation. So, of course, this is very far from proof, but at least often, if you're making some manifestly false statement, like some simple examples will immediately reveal that it doesn't work. And so far, we haven't managed to find such a simple example. And there's also, it's actually very, very simple to prove that F is constant along marginal lines. That's like essentially a one-line argument. Because the derivative of f with respect to a marginal operator is a one-point function, but the one-point function on the sphere is always zero just by conformal invariance. Okay, so this is basically what we know so far. We've also very recently, with Subir and Silvio Puffo and Ben Safdie, we looked at other CFTs. As I mentioned, in three dimensions there are lots of CFTs, so QED with large number of flavors is one class of CFTs, or general gauge theory. There is a kind of conformal window, except this conformal window has only one edge, right? You can make the number of flavors as large as you like. In four dimensions, it's the asymptotic freedom that gets you, but here the theory is sort of, you can push an F. So in U1 gauge theory, I think it's believed that the lower bound is four flavors, four Dirac fermions, something like that. But we looked at the large NF, and there you can also do a computation of F for such theories. The interesting thing is that there is a logarithm of NF plus NB, like the number of fermions plus the number of bosons. And it's similar to the logarithm you see for Chern-Simons theory. And in fact, these logarithms, they sort of add in quadrature, these quantities. So then this enables you to make some more tests of the theorem when you make some flavors massive, and it again doesn't appear to violate it. So now if you, one big question about all of this is what does it mean and what does it really have to do with the number of degrees of freedom in the theory? And here I think there is a kind of parallel line of research that has been pursued by first Myers and Sinha and also Cassini, Huerta, and Myers, who basically were computing entanglement entropy in, say, 2 plus 1 dimensional CFTs for some very simple geometry. So if you look at the, so now you're not working in the Euclidean, you're working in just real time. Then you just have a theory, say, on a plane, and suppose you want to compute entanglement between the inside of a circle, say region A, and the outside of a circle, which is region B. Then just on general, and suppose this is a conformal field theory. Then on general grounds, you would just say that this S entanglement will have the structure, which is some non-universal number, perhaps, times the radius divided by UV cutoff. But then there will be an additional finite correction to this. And what they managed to prove is that this finite correction is precisely minus what we call F. And this is done by some clever techniques using conformal maps and So in other words, the universal piece of this entanglement entropy, which is scale invariant, is precisely minus this Euclidean path integral on Euclidean free energy on the three sphere. And this certainly makes F something a bit more tangible, because clearly this entanglement has something to do with the law. This is what people would call long-range entanglement, right? Again, here you're using a very simple geometry, right? Because it's round, it can't depend on any ratio, so it's just a number. Like when people compute, say, entanglement for some sort of strip, right? Then it depends on the distance between the plates, because it goes like the length of the line divided by the width. But circle is round, so this is just a number, and this number is exactly what we have been computing. So.
And they make that proof on that. They often do things holographically. That proof is on the field.
No, this is completely general proof. In fact, there was work. There are various ways of doing this argument. It has to do with causal diamonds, right? Like experts on entanglement entropy, they have this sort of master Hamiltonian. When you draw this, for example, if you do it in one dimension, let's just do the one dimensional case, which is the simplest. So here you could be computing the say the entanglement between the segment and its complement. Then they consider the sort of causal diamond, which is the two light-like lines here and two light-like lines here. And then you can then you have to map this region to Rindler wedge, essentially. And after mapping to Rindler wedge, you see that this is a thermal entropy of essentially the sitter. It's like a de Sitter thermal entropy. And then you can compute that on the Euclidean de Sitter. That's in a nutshell how the argument. So it's completely not holographic. I think the proof is general. And at least it gives some more validity to this quantity F and makes it a bit more physical. Because just saying you do the Euclidean theory on a three sphere, it doesn't seem so physical. And moreover, there is one implication of this is that perhaps it's really the entanglement entropy itself that is the monotonic function. I think that idea has been sort of advanced. It's very hard to check because I think it's very hard to compute the entanglement entropy in non-conformal theories. Like in conformal ones for special geometries, you can do these maps and do the computation. But if I give you just some massive theory, it's a pain to do the computation. And often they're done numerically. So I find this conjecture pretty sensible that this particular entanglement decreases along flows, but I don't know how to check it very much. So that's basically what the status of this is. I think definitely there is something nice and round about three spheres in all dimensions, and certainly in four dimensions. It appears to work. There is the A theorem. In two dimensions, there is the C theorem. So hopefully there are extensions to odd dimensions along these lines.
But so the last one was that perhaps the entanglement entropy of this or
yeah,
exists in any dimensions.
Right. Yeah. I think in what happens in even dimensions is that there is a logarithmic term. So it's again this logarithmic term that measures the anomaly.
F in all dimensions.
Yeah, I think what happens, for example, in four dimensions, at least we checked it in some examples, and I think there is many years of work on these entanglement computations, but I think the upshot in B equal 4 is that if you look at the spherical entangling surface as 2, then the entropy is A times R squared over epsilon squared. And I think this piece is exactly minus A times log R over epsilon. And this is just the A coefficient of the theory. And the proof goes along the similar lines. Yeah, I think this was even checked numerically for a free scalar field and stuff. Yeah, in odd dimensions, again, you don't see the log, you just have a number. So I think what would be interesting is indeed to study entanglement along flows and yeah, at the moment, this equivalence is only at the end points. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, along the flow, it appears that, like, we've done some simple computations. Like, for example, you take the three sphere, you add just a mass for the scalar field. What you get has nothing to do with entanglement entropy. It's just some quantity which has nothing to do with it. And nor do you get something monotonic. And so you don't want to be working on a three sphere there, probably. You want to really work on this geometry and start increasing the radius. And then you get some function of R times the mass. I think, I don't know what the full status of this is, but would be interesting. Okay, thanks a lot.
QED and QCD in three dimensions, the bottom of the conformal window is not known. So I was wondering if you could make a prediction where the conformal window closes. I mean, it's estimated by Schwinger-Dyson equations.
Right.
They're considered to be pretty unreliable. And there's actually numerical evidence that they're wrong, because people seem to see conformal-like behavior below the number of flavors where the Schwinger-Dyson equations say that the conformal window should be closed. So I'm just wondering, the Applequist et al. Thermal inequality, they were able to make some prediction, let's say in QED3, the number of flavors is something like 3/2, whereas Schwinger-Dyson would predict 4. So there's a pretty big difference there between...
Yeah, as I mentioned, I think in this particular dimension, I think the thermal inequality I find suspect.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Because I showed that it's...
But can you use this method to come up with a better estimate of the bottom of the conformal?
Yeah, we actually, we were sort of looking at some similar things. And so one conjecture would be, so if this F coefficient starts going negative somewhere, that's bad, and this already indicates some non-unitarity of the theory. But I believe that what happens at the edge of the conformal window is that some operator starts saturating the unitarity bound. For example, in the known examples of cyber conformal window with n equal 1 supersymmetry, you just have an operator which just hits the delta equal 1 unitarity bound. So my suggestion would be to look for that sort of thing in these type of theories.
Well, why don't you just compute f of the chiral Lagrangian of the broken theory and say if the conformal window extended to low enough flavors, then presumably f, you'd have too many Goldstone bosons and f would have
that might work. I just have a hunch that the unitarity bound for some one operator will be violated first. Even like F may still look positive, because I think that's what happened to Seiberg's theory. There, the A, like what happened at the edge is not that the A went negative, but it's like there was some operator becoming bad. But to be honest, I mean, this is something I'd like to work on, because we actually, there is something interesting, very concrete, that can be done using localization, which we have been looking at that for a while. Take, say, UNC gauge theory with n equal 2 supersymmetry and say NF flavors. There is an integral that can be done numerically. I mean, you can write down the type of integrals that I showed. And one can, but you have to do this F maximization there. So we saw that there are, if you say take, say, NC equals 3, as you start reducing an F, you see operators hitting unitarity bound or going below unitarity bound. So that is certainly something bad already happening. I believe at those values, F is still positive. So my gut feeling right now is that F might still be positive, but the theory is already losing unitarity. But I think this technique of Jefferies actually opens a possibility for at least supersymmetric theories. You can study this question much more precisely, as you don't need to simulate the theory. You just do these integrals and maximize them. Yeah, I think that is another thing that people do is they do the large N expansion and then just extrapolate this to compute like a few terms and then extrapolate it down to n equal 2 or 3. We actually did some examples of this for super QED, and it works extremely well. It's like amazingly good 1 over n expansion in these examples. Without supersymmetry, it may not work this well. But one could just do the 1 over, like the next term in 1 over n expansion and try to see. Again, because people work out these operator dimensions, right, and see where they cross unitarity bound.
So which
way? Cyber psi, no, something like that.
Yeah, but the one which gets bad.
I think it's cyber psi. That could... Yeah, because Cyber Psi in the large N theory, which is almost free, right, it has dimension 2, right? The unitarity bound is 1. I think what you see in the 1 over n expansion is that you see that delta of psi bar psi, and this is summed over flavors, is 2 minus some number over nf plus, I believe only this coefficient is known, for example, and one can just roughly deduce where it's going to cross the unitarity bound. But yeah, maybe by combination of these different things, one can get a better feel. I would certainly suggest to look at these supersymmetric theories, because that's something that have only been possible to do like for a year, and it's a very precise method.